Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience with Darren and Mark and a special guest.
Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience podcast series. Each podcast will explore a different element of the fan experience and fan engagement. Some of them will look at the match day experience, while others will look at more broader themes. But every podcast will deliver value to anyone listening in football, or indeed any other spectator sport. So whether it's general advice you need or ways to help you to start a conversation with your own colleagues, we reckon a regular dose of the fan experience will make a big difference. So join me, Mark.
And me, Darren, as we explore ways of improving the experience on match days, making clubs more sustainable and relying less on winning to keep fans engaged.
And if you'd like to find out a little bit more about us, the work we do, and the Fan Experience Company, you can visit www.fanexperienceco.com. So welcome to this podcast, and this one is a special, and our focus is the academic view of engagement. And to pursue that line of inquiry, we're delighted to have Kenneth Courton with us. Kenneth is a Danish sports management researcher from Aarhus School of Business. He's Aarhus University. He comes from Aalborg. He's someone we've known for a couple of years now, and he's got a fascinating perspective on engagement and the commercial elements of it in football. Hi, Kenneth. How are you?
I'm doing well, Mark and Darren, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be part of this podcast.
Oh, it's fantastic to have you too. It's, you know, since first meeting you in November last year, of course, we were connected by a mutual friend, Baz Schnatter, who's a data and fan experience and engagement expert from the Netherlands. He put us in touch. We were able to visit you in your natural environment in Aalborg last November, and we had some fantastic conversations there. So it seemed like a natural opportunity to pick up on some of those and you know, have them in today's podcast. So how are you feeling? How are you dealing with the pandemic over there?
Yeah, it's a crazy time. You know, I've been working from home since the middle of March, so that's tough in itself with two boys, age 5 and 8, that have also been home for a month. Now they started school and kindergarten again, but we've tried to make the best out of it in terms of, you know, this is also increased family time. In terms of football, everything has been stopped since the middle of March, as in most countries around the world. So that has been weird as well, because I spent usually 4 or 5 days at least per week going to Aalborg BK, where I am the head coach for the women's team. And actually, I was laid off by the club as of the end of June because of the corona situation. So this is a tough situation, not only for people in terms of social isolation and individually, but also for football clubs.
No, you're quite right. And I think what Darren and I are trying to do with this series of podcasts is to actually look at things in two different contexts, you know, now during the pandemic, and also, you know, hopefully when football does return with fans. So your a big area of your research has been, you know, the commercial side of sport, and, you know, how sports leagues and clubs can generate more revenues from perhaps a little bit more academic and informed approach to the way that they deal with their fans and fan engagement more generally. I mean, for me, the first question I was going to ask you is that, you know, you've analysed the economics of fan engagement in a lot of detail. Is it all just about winning?
I mean, winning definitely helps in elite sports. And also, if you look at academic perspectives on fan engagement, there are concepts such as burging or coughing, basking in reflected glory or cutting off reflected failure, that definitely taps into whether you're winning or not in terms of fans identifying more with the team that is winning and saying, you know, they lost 4-0 if their team is losing. So you definitely see a sense of more fan engagement when a team is winning, because some of the fans that are not usually coming to the stadium week in and week out will suddenly be there to take part of the celebrations and take part of the talk of the town. But I really like your approach to fan engagement, because winning is so hard to control. I mean, the quality of the sporting product is tough to control, also with the uncertainty of the outcome element linked to the randomness of football. So winning definitely plays a role, but it is very important for football clubs to go beyond that aspect, to seek to take more control of other elements of the fan experience as well, like you guys do.
What are the, because you're right, Kenneth, we constantly tell clubs don't rely on winning, because it's just out of your control and you have to look at the other things and almost assume that you may go through a spell when things aren't going well. So from that angle, what do you think clubs should be focusing on if they're not, you know, to try and get fans engaged without having to rely too much on what's happening on the pitch?
The way I look at it is that you need to strive to produce good comprehensive experiences across various segments and target groups. Like I said, the quality of the sporting product is hard to control, so you must also seek to build some relevance in terms of the other peripheral offerings of the football product. So I think it is important to treat fans as friends of the house across all customer touch points, whether the fans are kids, men, women, sponsors. I mean, take this analogy. What do you do when you invite guests to your house? There are some important questions to answer using that analogy. Do you strive to make sure that they enjoy their time? For instance, you put on a cartoon for the kids if that is what they want to do. You strive to make sure that the quality of the food is good, that there is a good atmosphere, that the mood of the crowd is positive. You tell people to bring their A game, and you will strive to you know, do the same. And you also look at the quality of the entertainment choices. So I think stuff like that is very important. And always for a football club, recognition is the first step to a new reality. So you should also be able to look at where are you now and what you do now, is that good enough?
Yeah, I think I absolutely love that analogy of the, you know, welcoming somebody to your home.
It's just been that long since anyone's been to my home. I think I'm out of practice, to be honest.
Well, I'm doing quite well. I must be a bit like one of the football clubs that we assessed in the early days, where I don't give anybody directions, so they don't know how to find my house. When they do, there's no paper in the toilet, and I'm just playing Pink Floyd records from 1975. You know, so, you know, I think it's a wonderful analogy. I think what's wonderful about that as well is that it's something you can share with employees at clubs, because, you know, whether the senior team at the club has engaged with the idea of getting closer to fans or not, a lot of this falls upon people who are actually working in the clubs. And I just love that analogy. I'm going to use that with your permission, with you know, when we're talking to people in clubs. You're from Denmark, Kenneth, as we've established at the start. And you know, as you know, we've been working with the Superliga for a couple of years, and also with the Kvindeliga as well, the newly launched women's league in Denmark. Darren and I love Denmark. We love going there. It's hard for you to see it when you're in there, but for someone from England who loves football, coming to Denmark, I think we both see it. It's a pure football. It seems very pure. Each of the clubs seem to have very, very strong identities. One is much different from the next. And, you know, like in England, some of the characteristics of football in England and the way we approach it are helpful, and some are less helpful. So when you look at Danish football, how do you characterise it? When it comes to engagement, what does it have in its favour? And where do you think it could possibly do more or think differently?
To start with the latter, I think one challenge is the size of the market. I mean, Denmark is not a big country, between 5 and 6 million people totally. And we have, at the moment, 14 clubs in the Super League competing for the attention, time, and money of consumers or fans. So this is somewhat a constraint in terms of filling the stadiums, but this combined with the fact that the Danish society is also rich in consumer choices is also a challenge, because there's so much to do today. So there's an ongoing competition in terms of, like I said, the attention, time and money of consumers from various organizations, not only football clubs, but organizations within the broader concept of also not only other sports of the sports industry, but also the experience economy. So that's one side. Another challenge is the quality of the product, which we talked about before is hard to control. So with the quality of the sporting product being hard to change, and you also have a situation where people today are so exposed to high quality football all the time, this may also play a role. But with that being said, you also have a situation where if you look at the Danish football experience, there is the local and regional identity of the clubs, which is also an important element, because the best live stadium experience is in the Super League in Denmark, if you don't have to travel far. So I think that's a big advantage. Football is still the best show in town, or it has the potential to be the best show in town if you look at the popularity of football. But going back to what I talked about before, recognition is the first step to a new reality. So you also need to add some resources and some focused efforts to work with fan engagement. You need the right habits, which will shape behavior and eventually shape culture. So when you want to shape or create a new reality around fan engagement in football clubs, the way I see it, there's also a cultural dimension in terms of football clubs also being cultural reflections of strong narratives and legacies. If you look at FC Barcelona, to take an international example, FC Barcelona is also a political symbol for the Catalan people. So football also being a cultural product here, to me, adds emphasis to football should be meaningful and relevant for people locally and regionally and nationally. And you talked about identities, Mark, and I think there's a strong cohesion here between trying to produce relevance and meaningfulness around football, and then identities, because these local, regional, national identities and thus the shared history values of the clubs is very important here. If you look at some international clubs, Bayer Leverkusen in Germany is definitely associated with the Bayer medical company, because it was a club established back in time, to give workers an opportunity for leisure time activities. And the same with the names of the clubs in England, like City or United. It is also names that reflect the meaning of a shared history or a local or regional identity. So the most important job for football clubs when producing these cultural goods is to emphasize the fact that these cultural goods should be meaningful and relevant, not only in an isolated time, right here, right now, but also over time. So there's also a time factor here.
So I couldn't agree more, Kenneth, on the cultural element. I mean, we talk to a lot of clubs, but also to the leagues and associations, and we always start with culture, because, you know, on a very simplistic level, we say if the culture isn't right and people don't want to change, then it's going to be very hard anyway. But also, we want those leagues and clubs to do things that are very sort of unique to that country and reflect outwards what that country or what that club is all about. So my question was going to be, how, from what you've seen on your travels and in Denmark especially, how could the clubs at a very, you know, it's a high level in terms of the people who own the clubs and run the clubs, how could they achieve more of that and what could they do to get that culture out to other people and to fans especially?
I talk a lot with Stephen Grazer from Harvard University, who taught the course, The Business of Sports, for many years, and also wrote a book with the same name. And he was part of coining what him and John Barmer called the AC2 ID test. And it's an interesting tool also to apply in football here, because it is testing your way of managing multiple identities. So the way I see football clubs when I travel across various countries, whether it's, you know, Danish football, English football, German football, or football or soccer in the US, it's always a matter of clubs understanding their current situation. You must understand who you are, where you want to go. You must have intentions in terms of how you communicate with people and thus how you want to be perceived. And most importantly, always strive to constantly scan the internal and external environments of or for new relevant trends and tendencies, and aim to have your fingers on the pulse regarding how to go about the optimal resource allocation. And here I'm also talking in terms of fan engagement. So if you focus on how you communicate with people and how you want to be perceived, we are back to what I started saying regarding how do you treat people when they come to your home, right? And here it is always relevant also to have good ownership and management, because it starts with people at the top level and how they interact with their employees and external stakeholders. So if it starts from the top, look at examples such as Liverpool FC or Golden State Warriors in basketball. I mean, Liverpool came from a troubled ownership situation with Hicks and Gillett to what Fenway has done to the club in terms of taking them to a new position on top of the world. So there's definitely also a contrast between good ownership and management and problematic ownership and leadership. And it motivates me to say, does culture eat strategy for breakfast? I mean, some people say so, but I don't fully believe this. There are more colors to it than black and white. And I believe that football clubs should realize that culture and strategy can go hand in hand, in the sense that football clubs must strive to demonstrate strategic and cultural capabilities, because they are doing business not only in one marketplace, but across various interrelated marketplaces, such as they have to deal with media stakeholders, the business-to-business side in terms of sponsors, inviting them to the stadium, but also the business-to-consumer side in terms of ordinary fan segments and all the differences across these fan segments. And they must be able to cater to their needs. And it's a discipline of much complexity. So if you don't understand the strategic and cultural side of this, fan engagement can be a tough discipline.
So we try to boil it down to kind of, you know, we're often dealing with clubs outside of the elite who are limited when it comes to resources. You know, like we talked to Hobro, Ranners, clubs like this, Lungbu, who don't have a lot of money. And here in England too, we do focus on that. We focus on identity as a key part of that. We look at communication and engagement in terms of getting to know the local community. We look at the experience itself and also the people to make sure that they've been fully bought into the ideas that each club have. And, you know, our first couple of years in Denmark, we've uncovered some things, some good practices that have now become standard examples of best practice when we're talking about things like family engagement to other clubs in Europe. And Brøndby, well known for their new purpose-built fan zone, but perhaps less well known for the way they create an experience that allows families with the young kids to enjoy it just as much as the hardcore for which the club is well known. And then, Odense, a dedicated family zone, was introduced a season ago. And when talking to Jack there, he was telling me that that was the thing that had the biggest impact on their, I think it was a 32% increase in average home attendances. You know, so we're seeing clubs in Denmark, probably more than any other country, open to change and open to doing things differently. But let's move from the men's game to the women's game. Obviously, you've been heavily involved in the women's game. So if we look generally at that across Europe, and we look at engagement, you know, we have fewer resources. You know, we've seen that the pandemic has led to a lot of people losing their jobs. What do you think the steps should be for leagues, women's leagues, and for women's clubs? What can they do with engagement to strengthen, you know, their sustainability in the future?
Yeah, it's a good question, Mark. And I've been a women's coach, elite coach, since January 2018 when I switched from the men's side. And I've also done research in women's football. And with this in mind, it is clear to me that women's football need continued strategic support. For instance, FIFA recently implemented a new women's football strategy, striving to grow participation and to improve the associated commercial potential, and also to orchestrate a pathway for more women in football. And you know that UEFA has done similar things in terms of the UEFA Grow program that we both have been associated with. So I think that's a very important part. Because all these strategic support functions are fundamental to resume, but you also still need to have more work done in terms of establishing female role models and strong voices, similar to what Billie Jean King was and still is for women's tennis. So I think there's a good bridge to women's tennis, because the WTA has really done a fantastic job in terms of commercializing the sport. But I think another important aspect is the big gap that we've seen, especially in Denmark, between the national team success during the European Championship in 2017 and the reality in the best Danish women's football league. However, you know, the league and the clubs are working hard and doing a decent job to activate the clubs and all the stakeholders in producing a better scenario for fan engagement in women's football.
How do you think they can do that? The national team, and obviously we see this a lot where a national team has a really fantastic tournament or a couple of tournaments, and there's some real interest and engagement off the back of that. But then it has to go into the clubs at a much deeper level and for much longer. What do you think the clubs, especially in the leagues, could do to get more from that successful tournament?
I think it's a matter of resources. You need to constantly drive the branding of the women's game to the next level. So if you look at a simplistic branding model, it would start with awareness. So you need to articulate the strength of the women's game. You need more people, female players at a young age going into football. That helps as well. And we have seen a very good job in Denmark and elsewhere in Europe working on the image of women's football. Years ago in Denmark, people used phrases like life is too short for women's football, or football is a men's game. And when you attach such labels to a sport, it's hard to get rid of these labels. And this comes back to culture. I mean, culture is not changed overnight, but the governing bodies like FIFA, UEFA, the national FAs and the leagues, including bringing in competent people like Mark, for instance, all that helps in terms of removing the negative stigmatization or marginalization that was attached to women's football. So working on the image is also key here, because if you want to built brand equity around the sports product of women's football, you need to produce these positive differentiating points or factors that in the long run will lead to better brand preferences or more fan loyalty. So there have been some good work done in women's football so far, and we need to continue that. That strategic support is fundamental. However, I'm afraid of the fact that women's football can be really hit by the corona situation, unfortunately.
Yeah, this does seem to be the situation right now. It'll be interesting to see how national associations defend this situation, because, you know, we work closely with UEFA on the women's game. There's a lot of investment taking place, and you know, UEFA won't want to see that lost.
Kenneth, I was doing some research before we went on air with the podcast, and one of the articles and some comments that really fascinated me was about a trip you made to the Boston Red Sox. And in it, they'd asked you, and you can tell us about it in a moment, but they'd asked you if you wanted to sit next to a season ticket holder, and that obviously enhanced the experience. But it just took me back to a game I did as one of our assessments in the Dutch league last season. And I went to Rotterdam to a Feyenoord game, and I just happened to sit next to a supporter who, as it turned out, was a season ticket holder. And he could obviously see me as a sort of assessor making notes on the game. And after about sort of 20 minutes of the first half, he said to me, what do you keep writing on your phone for, if you don't mind me asking? And I sort of told him, you know, without giving too much away, just said I was taking some notes to tell people about it when I got back to England. And because he was a season ticket holder, he then went on to tell me all sorts of things about the club. And for the next 70 minutes, he was telling me about the stadium, the history of the stadium, some of the players, about plans for a new stadium. And it took the experience to a whole new level, so much so that I had to remember at times to go back and make notes about the actual assessment. But that, for Boston Red Sox, was obviously something quite deliberate.
Yeah, it was a fantastic experience, and it highlights an example of a club exceeding a fan's expectations. So I heard lots of things about the Boston Red Sox, and I was in Boston, so of course I wanted to experience the Red Sox fan environment. And I walked from the city center to the iconic ballpark, Fenway Park, I went around the stadium and was in the area of the ticket booths, and one of the stewards of the club asked me if I was looking for a ticket, and I said yes, and where do I need to go? And he said, would you mind sitting next to a season ticket holder, because we have some extra tickets here? And I said, yeah, that would be fantastic. And he showed me to a different line, and I bought one of those tickets and found a good seat in the stadium. And most importantly, I shared my fan experience at Fenway Park with a fan that had been a fan for years. And to me, it was just such a great experience, because I got a chance to really tap into the legacy, the knowledge, the culture, the passion, all these aspects that really produce relevant meaning around a sports team. And most importantly, I went to the game with one expectation. And I mean, experience economy is all about producing these memorable, in a positive way, experiences, and, you know, to go the extra mile in terms of making sure that fans have a great experience, because that is a main reason for fans to go back to the stadium. And if you look at the monetary value of fan engagement, if you can produce a higher frequency in terms of when fans come to the stadium or to the ballpark or to the indoor arena, that that is something that impacts the financial bottom line positively.
I guess it takes us back to exactly where we started this whole conversation, that if the team doesn't win, those are exactly the sort of memories that are just going to overcome the fact that perhaps it didn't quite go well on the field.
Time for the roundup.
So on this podcast roundup, we just want to focus on one particular piece of news that's come out today, and that is the International Missing Children's Day on the 25th of May. As many of you will know, AS Roma began a social media campaign which raised awareness of missing children. And in fact, as a direct result of that, several children have been found. The club showed videos of missing kids when signing players over the past two transfer windows. And I think actually it is six kids that were found. And this Football Cares initiative is being supported by FIFA. And, you know, we want to take our hats off to that. It's wonderful that more clubs will now be doing that, including Chelsea, Liverpool and Tottenham from England, Celtic and Rangers from Scotland, Borussia Dortmund and Leverkusen from Germany, Inter Milan, Juventus, Lazio, Barcelona, Atletico Madrid and Valencia in Spain, and Cork City and Linfield from the Emerald Isle. So, Kenneth, what can I say? Thank you so much for being with us today. And for anyone that's listening, Kenneth referred to a book, The Business of Sports, by George Foster and Stephen A. Grazer. That's Greyser. You can look at some of Kenneth's work at www.kennethcortsen.com. And finally, Kenneth, just to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, it was a pleasure being here, Mark. And I think, Just to sum up, this podcast is a product of co-creation and co-creation and co-branding. These shared actions is what is very important, not only for the women's game, but also for the men's game. Pleasure being with you guys to participate in this podcast.
I think that basically brings our podcast to a close today. We look forward to you listening in to the next one. Thanks for your time, and we'll see you all very soon.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
And don't forget to check out our new website at fanexperienceco.com. The Fan Experience was recorded live. See you next time.